Welcome back to The Neuro Experience, everybody. I'm Louisa. I'm the host. I'm recording live from Sydney, Australia. Sunny Sydney, Australia. The sun is out, the birds are chirping, and the swell is absolutely phenomenal. I want to apologize in advance to the folks listening to me in freezing cold New York. My gosh, it just feels so great to be back home. I'm visiting the family for Christmas. So I hope everybody is enjoying their holidays with their loved ones. Today's episode is very important. We're going to be talking all about muscle mass, hypertrophy, and longevity. And I know you're probably thinking, but Louisa, you touch on this so often. And while that may be well and truly true, today I am joined by an absolute master. You've probably heard of him. His name is Stuart Phillips. He's been on the Found My Fitness podcast. He's been on many of the biggest podcasts in the world. And I knew that as soon as I heard his clip with Rhonda Patrick, I knew I had to bring him on. And we actually had an amazing conversational-based podcast episode. So it's not going to be an episode where we really go into the nuances of hypertrophy, muscle spindles, longevity. We're really just stepping back and having a conversation and talking about fitness and muscle mass and how to optimize your nutrition to get the best out of your training. So Stuart is a professor of kinesiology at McMaster University in Canada. He also serves as the director of the Physical Activity Center of Excellence, and his research center really revolves around the roles of exercise and nutrition and how they play in influencing human skeletal muscle protein turnover and how these lifestyle factors influence body composition, especially as we age. Now, Stuart has authored over 150 different papers. I'm sure if you do a random search, you will find that he is at the top tier as it relates to academic research. So he knows what he's talking about. And I'm sure you're going to get a lot out of this. But the best thing you'll probably learn is the fact that Mother Nature has gifted us with everything that we need. We have sunlight. We have the ability to exercise. It doesn't mean you have to go to the gym. We have the ability to sleep, and we have the ability to put proper nutrients in our body. Now, just like me, Stuart is an omnivore. He doesn't really subscribe to any diet. He doesn't say no to plants, doesn't say yes to only plants. He is just someone who enjoys everything. He enjoys meat. He enjoys plants. He enjoys working out. And he also believes that you don't need to go and kill yourself at the gym. No, you can do basic exercise around your house to get the training effects. So stay with me as we move on to today's episode with Dr. Stuart Phillips. Oh, and before I forget, guys, NeuroAthletics has a very well-performing newsletter. I'm going to link it below. For those of you who haven't subscribed, it is a free weekly newsletter that goes out to over 50,000 high performers. And this newsletter breaks down the medical and scientific literature that you need to perform at your peak. So make sure you go through it, spend a second putting your email address in, and you will receive something very special from yours truly in your inbox. I primarily, Stu, reached out to you a few months ago. You've been inundated, but I reached out to you because I love following you, and almost every podcast that I do, somebody is quoting you. And I think that's because you are one of the leading authorities when it comes to protein and, of course, skeletal muscle. So I just want to ask you, what is the main reason why you decided to go down this field and really just, understand skeletal muscle, understand protein and how that relates to longevity?
Yeah, I think it's a gradual story that really starts with, I did an undergraduate degree in biochemistry, and I knew I really liked science. I liked understanding how things work. And so, you know, that was the genesis of it. And I've always been a more of a reductionist. But then during my last year of my undergraduate, this is sort of an infamous story now. I broke my leg playing rugby. And so I couldn't play rugby, which was one of my sort of, one of my main reasons for you know, going to university was to play rugby. And I had to do a senior thesis because I had more time than I knew what to do with. So, and then all of a sudden, I gravitated towards research. I took a nutrition class in my last semester of my fourth year of undergraduate. And I was like, this is amazing. Like, this is with people and, you know, I can do this. And then that grew into physiology and that grew into exercise because that's the population I studied in my master's. And then it's just grown from there. The muscle centric end of things really comes by the choice of studying protein more than, you know, fat or carbohydrate. Then you care about things like liver and maybe muscle a little bit and other things, but, muscle is protein. So it really, they were just two things that went hand in hand. And, it's, you know, I've been a McMaster for 26 years now, so it's almost a career.
You say muscle and it relates to so many different aspects. And now we're hearing a lot about it on social media. And it's funny because 10 years ago, people were talking about muscle in terms of, all right, we're going to go to the gym and just build muscle. We weren't really at the mercy of understanding its relationship when it comes to longevity, et cetera. So I want to start there by really understanding what the importance of resistance training is as it relates to healthy aging, and why is having skeletal muscle so incredibly important as you age?
Yeah, so I can kind of divide my career up into sort of two stages. You know, when I first joined the university, we were really concerned about muscle and muscle mass and younger people about, you know, trying to get it as big as possible and strong as possible. And you know, that was great. Lots of really great research, lots of fun studies, lots of uptake by, you know, athletes and sports teams, et cetera. And then I think as I got a little bit older, so research becomes me-search, right? I'm interested in what's happening. And I also took over being the director of what's called the Physical Activity Center of Excellence, which is a community access program at McMaster in the Department of Kinesiology. And we have about 500 community people coming in to use an exercise facility. And the average age of the folks in there is about 72. And all of a sudden, you know, this aging thing kept coming up and up and up. And, you know, I said, well, those people have the same goals as the young athletes. That is to be as mobile as they can. And obviously they're not climbing on a podium. Maybe some of them are, but it's really the same thing. It's just about slowing the decline and the aging aspect of things rather than it is building things up in the young aspect of things. But skeletal muscle, and the way I kind of explain it to most people, and particularly older people, is to say that it's functional reserve. It's the tissue that you rely on when you're in stressed situations. And really, the decline in skeletal muscle, or what we now call sarcopenia, was once considered this sort of inevitable age-related process. But we know now that we can, you know, we can push back against that with being physically active, and particularly participation in resistance exercise, and probably by consuming a higher, at least than recommended, dietary protein intake. So, you know, those two sort of things, you know, they just melded all of the interests I had with muscle and physiology and biochemistry, and then in its application to aging. And now I sort of really begun to embrace the fact that that's a pretty cool meld of some of the stuff that we had done before.
Hey folks, we'll be back with Stuart in just a moment. But for now, I'd like to bring your attention to the world's best ketone drink, Ketone IQ from HVMN. If you follow me on Instagram, you'll see that I've been going really hard on the ketone research lately. And that's because exogenous ketones are like rocket fuel for the brain, especially when it comes to optimization. So this drink, Ketone IQ, made by HVMN, delivers clean fuel that can cross the blood-brain barrier, supplying your brain and body with sustained energy, mental focus, and sharpness, putting you in flow for lasting hours. So if you want to check out this drink, or even if you've been curious about ketones, you can try this one. You can get 20% off by using my code, which is NEURO, at checkout. I'll link everything below in the show notes. FYI, for anybody who's looking at curbing their appetite, or if you're doing intermittent fasting, this is probably the best thing that you can be having when you wake up, so you don't have to feel lethargic or fatigued, especially mentally fatigued. You can sip on this and curb your appetite and keep that mental energy firing until your next meal. So go to hvmn.me/neuro, or simply just go to HVMN, go to Ketone IQ Drink, and click Neuro for 20% off. So then, and this is going off script now, but what is muscle? So if we were to tear our bicep off the tendon and just really, I know that the bicep is not just one muscle, but let's just, for argument's sake, we pull a muscle off the bone. What is it made of? Because I know in part when we talk about longevity and we talk about skeletal muscle, we are referring to, in some part, to certain hormones, but also mitochondria. So we know that there's mitochondria in muscle, but let's tear it apart right now and do a bit of a crash anatomy course.
Sure. The thing I like to sort of remind people is that of all of the macronutrient substrates that we eat, when we talk about fat and carbohydrate, they're fuel. I mean, we burn those, and we have a really small requirement for essential fats. But protein that we eat gives us dietary amino acids, strings of little building blocks of protein, and it's a functional substrate. We build stuff with it. We build muscle. We build skin, heart, liver, like all of these things they're made out of protein. So it serves a different role than the other dietary macronutrients that we're talking about. So from the muscle standpoint, I like to pull it into sort of two different pools. One is the myofibrillar, or what we call force-generating contractile proteins, things that make your muscle shorten and generate force so that you can pick things up, stand up, walk around, do all the things that you want to do. And the other non-myofibrillar would include things like, as you pointed out, mitochondria, things inside the cell that would allow the cell to function. And then outside of that, and I think this is maybe a little bit forgotten, there's it's sort of like a scaffold or a lattice of collagenous tissue that gives the muscle its sort of shape and structure. The muscle, if it didn't have collagen, would be this sort of like flabby, bag of contractile proteins and a few other organelles inside the cell. But this collagenous lattice gives it the real strength. So there's always sort of these collagen external fibers, if you like, that I always sort of call the scaffold, that give the muscle its shape, and then at the ends taper off and become the tendons that attach to bones that are going to be pulled together when you shorten the muscle. And I always point out to people, I always say this to my guys, I'm like, a muscle does nothing other than shorten. It lengthens, but it's always trying to shorten. No matter what,
really?
Everybody, they go, well, but when you're lowering the weight, and I'm like, yeah, but it's still trying to shorten, even though you're lowering the weight. So that's all it ever does.
That's all it ever does. So that's pretty much contraction, shortening of the muscle,
yep.
So even at rest.
Yeah. So, you mentioned the bicep, and so I shorten it in one direction, then it's the tricep that shortens to make it go in the other direction. So we've got these, what we call antagonist muscles, making, your lower arm there do different things. One is bringing it in, one's pulling it out, but it's always shortening of a muscle in one direction or another. And, your brain's smart enough to turn off the shortening of one muscle and activate the shortening of the other. And, when we lift weights, we get much better at doing that. So we're more coordinated. We're better at turning signals on and off and lighting up the fibers that we want to activate to generate the force that we want when we want it produced.
So when we're doing resistance training, which is, let's just say we're contract, we'll just stick to the bicep muscle this entire episode
yeah,
then.
Sure.
We do contraction of the bicep muscle with force, which is a weight of some kind. And when our bicep feels or generates that force, I don't know if I'm wording it correctly. How does it produce hypertrophy? Like, how do we get an increase in muscle cell size due to resistance training?
Yeah, great question. I wish I could give you a simple answer. I think if you go to YouTube, people would say that what the resistance training does is it generates damage within the muscle, and it's repair of that damage that creates hypertrophy. That's one hypothesis, and I think that there's some evidence to support that. There's also another population of cells inside your muscle which are almost the equivalent of muscle stem cells. And stem cells are these cells which can have different fates. They're non-programmed, we call them. But inside muscle, they're called satellite cells, and they probably contribute to the damaged muscle fibers and allow these fibers to get better after resistance exercise. But I think the fundamental piece of information that we're beginning to sort of unravel now is that muscle and probably bone and other tissues are mechanically sensitive. They're able to sense stretch and stress, and their response to that is to remodel and make new proteins to sort of withstand the stress. Because, I mean, exercise is stress, and its response to the stress, if it's successful, is to make you more resistant to the stress itself. So if it's an energetic stress, like aerobic exercise, you make more mitochondria. Sort of makes sense. But if it's a contractile stress, like resistance exercise, then you're going to make more contractile proteins. And so if you think about the muscle fiber, then what it does, if you're adding more proteins inside it, it gets bigger. And in doing that, then if you sort of add that up on a fiber by fiber basis, you can see the diameter of your muscle obviously getting bigger as well. The ceiling is probably, you got to blame your mom and dad. It's probably more genetic than anything else.
Wow. So in saying that, does that mean you can build skeletal muscle without producing mitochondria, more mitochondria?
Yeah, good question. Probably not. My sense is that when you increase the size of the muscle, it would be an energetic disaster to dilute the amount of mitochondria in there, because the distances within the cell are pretty critical in terms of supplying energy to new contractile proteins. So I think you have to get the mitochondria as well. It's sort of the argument, and I have a good colleague and friend, Marty Gabal at McMaster, and he's sort of been the HIIT and aerobic guy, and I've been the resistance training guy. But I think we can both agree that, optimal health comes when you do both, not just one or the other. I'm a big proponent, obviously, of resistance training, but I do think that, maintaining functioning mitochondria within muscle, maintaining good cardiovascular health, it's undeniable that contributes to health and longevity. But at some point when you get older, one of the things that's going to limit what you're going to be able to do is probably limited by strength or power. And the last one is, rising up out of a chair. If that doesn't matter how big your heart is or how good your lungs are. It's pretty much how much power you can generate in your quadriceps, for example.
And that's why it's super important to understand how to squat from a young age.
The most functional lift ever. Yeah.
Yeah. And by young age, I'm talking, if you haven't got these down packed in your late 30s, I would say early 40s, it gets really hard because almost every listener knows, and I bring this up in every episode. So my dad just turned 70. My mum's around 65, 66. I've had literal threats of death if they don't go to the gym. And I'm breaking up with you guys. Yep. So now they're at the gym 3 days a week, and I fight with their he's a physical therapist, and I've actually been told I'm not allowed to go back in there. They've kicked me out of their training facility because I just stand there and I watch them train my parents, and he's got them just doing really high reps, low weights, and there's no squatting happening. And I'm like, my parents need more than that, because you do need, you can't just go to the gym and just lift small weights and generate hypertrophy, correct? Or even strength. You've got to be pushing some load.
Yeah, I think there's probably a minimal load beyond which it becomes much easier to generate, size and muscle. It's probably somewhere about 40% of 1RM or above. So if you're doing repetitions to failure and it's approaching 30 or 40 repetitions, it's getting more endurance-like than it is resistance-like. There's no question about that. But I think it's got to be heavy or it's useless is maybe not the message. But I do think that the movements that you're prescribing to individuals have to be functional. Right. So, that rising out of a chair, it's a squatting maneuver fundamentally. And most people I know they're using their arms because that's the trance, but if you don't have the bars on a chair or armrests, then you're not going to get there. So I'm a big fan of sort of, even if it's a half squat, of getting older people to sort of bend their knees. And, a lot of them say, oh, my knees hurt. And I'm like, well, if you do this and keep doing it, you'll find actually your knees will hurt less. So it's functional movements that translate into everyday activities, I think, are something that you would aim for with older individuals. But, let's face it, I call the squat the most functional lift that you're ever going to do. Very few people find themselves, pushing a bar off their chest. Everybody does it, but from a motor standpoint, that standing up maneuver and walking around and everything, that's a squat, or even maybe a press or something like that. Extensions, okay. Curls, yeah, I get it. But really, squatting is, I think, the very, very most functional exercise.
Have you ever had to explain to people over the age of 60 or even 70 the importance of resistance training?
Yeah, I do it a lot, actually. Yeah.
How does that go?
It's not easy, because I do think, one of the things that I've sort of begun to recognize and notice is that there's so much information on the health benefits of aerobic exercise. And, a large part of that is due to things like Ken Cooper's longitudinal study. And, he was the father. He invented the term aerobics, like we're going to do an aerobics class. And I often muse to say, if Ken Cooper was a lifter and he did the Cooper longitudinal lifting study, we'd know a lot more about what resistance training does. Now, resistance training is beginning to catch up. And I like to point out that instead of having sort of health benefits where resistance is here and aerobic is here, they overlap a lot more than they do, having things that are completely separate. Being cardiovascularly fit is probably the exclusive domain of aerobic exercise, no doubt. Being strong and powerful is the exclusive domain of resistance training. Both together is much more than either one separately. So, do both. But this is the one that's forgotten over here. It's, 150 minutes and everybody kind of can rhyme off that guideline. Not many people follow it. But the 2 days a week that are, strongly recommended is the word, get forgotten. Let's say that.
Mm. Yeah, I often, when I explain this to my parents, I often, bring up all-cause mortality. And they freak out.
Yeah.
And there's a strong correlation. More increased skeletal muscle lowers all-cause mortality.
Yeah, I mean, I think the relationships we receive, for years and years, it was all about fitness, and this reduced all-cause mortality and, cardiovascular disease-specific mortality, et cetera, et cetera. And now we're beginning to see certain disease clusters. Cancer is one, even CVD, type 2 diabetes. Probably is as big in terms of magnitude if you just lift it versus, say, doing just aerobic exercise. But the two of them together, so if this is aerobic and this is resistance, then the two of them together actually lower all-cause risk even more. So, that either implies that they're additive in terms of the amount of work that you've done, or they're coming through different, I like to think, or my concept is they're targeting different functional, anatomical, and physiological systems that are adding together to create better health. So, that's always been my pitch to older people. And I say, give me 5 activities in a day that you struggle with. And usually they're limited by strength. it's opening the car door, and being able to sort of hold that they're heavy, being able to carry my groceries, being able to do this and go up a flight of stairs. And everybody goes, oh, that's your heart and your lungs. And I'm like, well, every time you're doing it with bags of groceries, it's also a push with one leg and another. Mm. So, I think that then begins to maybe let the message sink in for older people.
So then there's obviously there's a link, but there's also a difference between strength and hypertrophy. So does that mean that when you increase your muscle cell size and you create bigger muscles, does that mean you're also increasing strength?
Yeah, the generally sort of accepted paradigm is that, force is proportional across sectional area. So this muscle would generate less force than this muscle. I do think, however, we've undersold the idea that there's a neurological adaptation that goes along with resistance training that just makes you better at the skill of lifting heavy things. And, that includes your own body weight. So I do think that there's something that's a little distinct between mass and strength. The corollary of strength, if you're going to do it quickly enough, that's power. Then you probably need to get some degree of both. And the only reason I focus as much on skeletal muscle mass as I do is because it's a buffer against some of these, what we call these disuse events in aging, hospitalization, a sickness, or COVID. Everybody stayed inside, everybody reduced their activity levels. And what that does is if you're on a sort of a downward slope, which probably, and I know this is going to depresses me because I'm north of the age, probably in the middle of your fifth decade, so somewhere around your mid-40s, that's where the curve on a population level begins to bend downwards in terms of muscle mass and function and strength and everything. And so you're on this downward trajectory. And if you have one of these disuse events, it's a really accelerated decline for a period, then it sort of levels out. So now you've migrated, instead of being on this curve on the down, you've migrated down to this curve. And that's a shift of, could be 10 years of functional muscle mass and strength that you've given up. And then the difference is when you were young, you just, trained and you came back. When you're older, it doesn't come back, or it's much, much harder to come back from. So, even something like a flu, a bad flu, or you go into hospital with respiratory distress, and then you come home, and if you're living in Canada, you look outside and it says negative something on the thermometer, and it's snowing, and you're like, well, I don't want to go outside and shovel because I don't want to slip and fall. That's terrible. I feel like crap anyway. I've just been in hospital, so I'm convalescing, and that's a disuse event. And geriatricians talk about older people having a bad winter. And never really looking the same afterwards. And I'm convinced that's just disuse. It's an inactivity event that is leading to that sort of, precipitous little drop. And older people who experience those and in succession, they go downhill fast.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, back on the recovery thing. I mean, I, in my late teens and early 20s, until my mid-20s, I was an elite triathlete for Australia. And I look back on that time and I think about how many hours a week I was loading my body, resistance training, yeah. Also three sports and also brick training. And I think about that now and I'm doing probably a fifth of the amount of activity I was doing then. Yeah. And I just can't believe how I was able to recover. And that was, now I'm, X amount of years older. And I think, Jesus, I just can't believe I was able to do that. So I don't know, if I kept doing the sport, would I, maybe I'd be in the same position. I'm not sure. But I do know that as soon as you stop, whatever age you are, and you don't go back to that, it's very hard. Back, it's very hard.
Yeah. I think it's, everybody recognizes it, that it's sort of this common phenomenon that it just takes, it's not the doing of the activity. You can probably still push yourself to do it, but the idea of the recovery from it and the actually, if you do it, recovering from it, it's a longer process. And I think that the biggest thing that probably goes down as we age is, first of all, our ability to recover damage and muscle is probably not as good. At the same time, all those connective tissues, and particularly collagenous tissues and things in joints, ligaments, and cartilage and everything, they're just so very poorly supplied with blood that the ability to be able to remodel them and make them healthy again, it's just gone. Once I figure that out, I'll join you from a podcast in Tahiti, and it'll all be sipping a Mai Tai. And I'm like, yeah, I made my millions. But that's really, I think, the rate limiting step for older people.
I completely agree. And I want to talk to you about protein, because obviously this is your field. Sure. I think no matter how many times I could talk about it on a podcast, I always learn something new. And unfortunately, protein falls into this nutrition bucket. And for some reason, it's the most controversial topic on the internet. Nutrition, for some, it is so controversial, because you've got these different food group people. You've got the carnivores, then you've got the vegans, then you've got the plant-based. I don't know if that's the same. Then you've got me, and I'm everything. I eat everything. I don't eat like kid sugar food, but look, I eat plants. I eat red meat. I eat
unapologetically omnivorous.
I get my bloods checked and I'm fantastic. So I've got nothing to really worry about in that aspect. So let's first understand what protein is. And so many questions came on Twitter and to my email when I put out saying that I'm going to be recording this with you. People want to know, how much protein do we need to have, and what's the anabolic window of protein, and when should I be ingesting it? So let's talk about everything regarding protein.
So let me say this, just before we hopped on the air, we were chatting, and so I've been a McMaster now for 26 years. If I add my grad work and everything, I've been doing this for over 30. So I've lived through when fats were bad and carbs were good. Every fat was just demonized. And so the food industry made a move that I think probably to its detriment and the public health detriment, just stripped fats out of food, but kind of replaced it, because fat makes a lot of things taste good. And, the devil that's now in the details is, mono and polyunsaturated fats, probably not as bad as saturated. And even some type of saturated fats, not as bad as we thought. So, we got a lot of simple sugars. So we were like, carbs are great. And then it's like, actually, it's the fiber and the starches that are probably better than simple sugars. And so then carbs had their, they were the whipping macronutrient. And so it was kind of protein's turn, right? I mean, we'd sort of, the protein folks have been like, we're good. We've got the halo. We're all good. Don't worry. Then everybody goes, protein makes your kidneys fail. And I'm like, yeah, okay. So these are my rider public service announcements. So first of all, that's about a 60-year-old hypothesis that we call the Brenner hypothesis. More protein makes your kidneys work. Your kidneys work too hard, your kidneys fail. So protein is a causative agent in that. Here we are 60 years further on from making that, and there's no evidence for that. We've reviewed it. Lots of other people have reviewed it. When you review clinical trials, even observational studies, no evidence. So I'll just put that one aside. The other is protein makes your bones soft. No evidence for that either.
I haven't heard that one.
Creates massive load. It just calcium out of your bones. It increases fracture risk. So here's the take-home statement. Dial in calcium, so 1,000 to 1,200 milligrams a day, particularly if you're a woman. Dial in vitamin D, and I get it. You get a lot more sunshine in Oz than I do in Canada, fair enough. But, let's say during winter, I'm taking 1,000 IUs a day. And I think that's a lot above where it's recommended, but that's what I do. Protein then becomes a bone-supportive nutrient, not detrimental. So it's actually, because 40% of your bone is protein by mass. Like, everybody thinks it's just a stick of chalk. But, if it was, we'd break bones all the time. So there is a collagen sort of, there's a little bit of bendiness in bones that actually allows them to not break all the time. So, that having been said, the latest kid on the block for protein is it's going to, shorten your lifespan. It's an anti-longevity nutrient. And that's mainly from evidence of laboratory animals. And we can digress as to why that might not be the best model for humans. But I'm of the opinion.
Can I cut in there and ask you, has that got anything to do with mTOR?
Yeah, that's an mTOR-centric hypothesis that is, you know, mTOR is this sort of canonically preserved protein that has a lot to do with skeletal muscle growth. So controlled growth, no problems. It's occasional stimulation of growth to prevent declines, like lifting weights, activates mTOR, all good. But continual high protein induced stimulation of mTOR begets uncontrolled growth. And so uncontrolled growth is cancer and, you know, lots of other issues as well. Aside from that, with somebody who's more exercise, muscle, protein centric, I look at protein as the nutrient that's going to support the tissue that you want to preserve as you age. And even people who agree or sort of say the protein is more of an anti-longevity macronutrient agree that older people need more protein. So let's say that, you know, you're going to get into your 60s and you're still on that low protein diet. You haven't got much muscle mass and you experience one of these disuse or catabolic events. That, I think, is the detriment or the downside of under-consuming protein. Over-consuming protein may not be the best thing either, but we're of the opinion that the current recommended dietary allowance or recommended nutrient intake or whatever your acronym is for your country of 0.8 grams of protein per kilo per day is about at least 50 to maybe 100% less than what I think you would require for optimal health. So instead of 0.8, it's 1.2 at least, or maybe as high as 1.6.
But are you referring to lean body mass, 1.6?
No. That's per kilogram of body mass. Now, if you've got somebody who's bigger, if they have a BMI over 30, then I normalize it back to whatever body weight they would have if they had a BMI of 30 all the time. So if they've got a BMI of 35, I normalize their body weight back and use that as the total amount of body weight. But it's not per kilogram of lean for the main reason that, you know, probably about 1 to 2% of the population knows what their lean mass is, but everybody can hop on a scale, and that's why we use kilograms of body weight.
Okay, let's take me for example, because I did stand on the scale this morning. I stood on the scale.
There you go.
I was like, "This is interesting." I fasted, and I am, as of today, I am 74 kilos. Mm-hmm. It's literally 74.00. That's 12 kilos above my race weight back in when I was a skinny triathlete. But so this is me. If I wanted to work out what my protein requirement is, I would do 1.6 per your recommendation times 74 kilos.
Yep.
And whatever that comes back with, because I can't do that fast math.
About 120 grams.
Thank you for the fast math. About 120 grams of protein per day. Needed to stimulate.
That's the big message. You want to get that in a given day. Then the more subtle messages underneath are, you know, how do I distribute it? How do I distribute it compared to when I exercise? What kind of type of protein should I be eating? What about plant versus animal? What about, you know, one of the things if your listeners take nothing else away, it's this, is that exercise is the foundation of all of this. So if we don't exercise, if we go to the gym once a week, you know, people are like, "Oh, I'm eating 2.2 grams per kilo or 1 gram of protein per pound of body weight." And I'm like, big deal. Like it's not doing anything for you. And I like to point out that probably 90% of the response just comes from going to the gym and lifting or exercise, whatever you do regularly, and then just eating food mixed, you know, regular sort of diets, not, you know, sort of skewing one way or another. And, you know, so we don't want to, I'm not going to besmirch any particular dietary pattern, but let's just say you're an omnivore or flexitarian or whatever it is. So you're eating the occasional animal protein, maybe it's mostly plants or something like that. As long as you're covering your energy needs, you're probably getting enough protein. And I know that tends to, that's a tough, you know, imagine how that tough that is for a guy. 30 years I spent researching this, and I'd love to be able to say protein is the unlock for everything, which is sort of the idea that you're given. And after studying it, and this is the science, we looked at all of the work that's out there, the incremental benefit of more protein is really small. It's the, I don't know what the analogy is. It's the cream on the sundae, or it's the sprinkles on the cream, or the cherry. I'm not sure which it is, but the banana and the ice cream and everything else, and you know, is that's going to the gym and doing it regularly.
Okay. Well, yeah, that's the hardest thing. And, you know, if we had more time, maybe in a separate podcast, we'd probably talk about the fact that I think that lies down to fundamentals of training. I think a lot of women and what I find in the age group of early 30s, because I've got a lot of, you know, girlfriends who I'm like, let's go to the gym. And if we do, I look at them, I go, what are you doing? I think a lot of people just don't understand, first of all, you know, the fundamentals of training. And then that, you know, over time is like, if I don't really understand the, I don't really feel like I'm going, I don't really want to go to the gym. And that's what I'm finding. And this is just observational data from myself. But I want to just, I mean, you can comment on that if you like.
I think it's the same. We've done enough work with women and resistance training. We're doing more, so stay tuned. And, you know, fundamentally, they adapt, relatively speaking, to the amount of muscle that they have almost as well as men. The difference is women, I want to get big and bulky. And I'm like, look, if you sense like you're getting big and bulky, tell me and we'll change your program. But, you know, in 20 plus years of doing this, I've never seen a big and bulky woman emerge from any of our programs. So let's just say that. Stronger? Absolutely. Improved, whatever you want to call it, self-esteem or self-efficacy to be able to do some daily tasks. They enjoy the experience. They genuinely, and they overcome, I think, the broad perception, and you can see it in the gym, right? Like, I mean, you know, the weights, well, there's, you know, big guys, leather belts, chalk dust, and that's just not where women hang out. But, you know, once you become confident enough to know what you should be doing and feel like I belong here, I think it's not a hard thing to do, but it's still very much, you know, in the gym at our university, this is the weights and this is where all the guys are. Then there's a gallery up here that's all the ellipticals and the bikes and the treadmills, and that's where all the women are.
Yeah.
And it's like, this is for burning calories and this is for making muscle. And I'm like, you do realize that this burns calories and it creates the tissue that burns more calories as well. And, you know, I think the dirty little secret that's beginning to come out now as well is that, you know, menopause is associated with a decline in bone mass and bone strength, but the same is true of muscle. It's a drop in muscle as well. And I mean, it's six to one, half dozen to the other. We're all concerned about bone, but then the tissue that pulls on bone and makes it strong and, you know, prevents us from falling is muscle. So maybe in the next 20, 30 years, women will have got that message, because it took about that long to get the osteopenia, osteoporosis message to women.
Yeah. Okay. So let's just stay on 120 grams of protein per day. Now, is there an anabolic window? Actually, can you just explain to us what this anabolic window is and if there is an anabolic window?
Yeah. So I think that there's two things. It's a little bit sort of inherent in answering the question is that most people, depending on when they work out, tend to consume their protein. And there's a small amount at breakfast, a sort of moderate amount at lunch, and then the largest is sort of at dinner at the end of the day. Now, if you're working out in the morning and, you know, maybe you have a bit of a snack or maybe you work out fasted, whatever it is, I'm not really too bothered, but I would, you know, my advocacy would be about adding some protein into that breakfast meal and trying to time your protein consumption relatively close to exercise. The obsession with, you know, I've got my shake here and as soon as the workout ended and I'm down, that's completely, it's, there's nothing to that. So exercise sets up your muscle to be more like a sponge. It's ready to soak in nutrients. It's ready to take up carbohydrates. It's ready to build new muscle proteins. But that window, particularly with resistance exercise, is open for a really long time. One group recently described it as more of a garage or a garage, a garage door. So it's open, it's big, it's for a long
garage.
Time. A garage, a garage, whatever. And so the obsession around, get my protein right away is not necessary. So being for most, mere mortals, if you're an athlete doing 2-a-days, absolutely, you got to rehydrate, refuel, get some protein on board right away. So I don't think it's absolutely necessary, but the more even sort of distribution at meals, because amino acids go up and down with each meal, and that turns on protein synthesis and turns off protein breakdown, turns on, turns off, turns on, turns off, is probably more effective. But the big picture is still 120 grams. If I had, if you're an athlete and I'm really wanting to fine tune things, then I'm like, we'd like to have 40 grams at every meal, 3 times a day, and that's 120. And you go, okay, well, I'd like a snack before I go to bed. And I'm like, okay, that's another 40 grams. And so now we're trying to cover more of our bases in evening out protein intake across the day.
So that brings me to my next question, which is muscle protein synthesis, because what I've heard is that you can't stimulate this process without having a certain amount of leucine in your serving of protein. So therefore you can't just have an egg white, right, and call it a day.
Yeah, it depends. So like everything in science, people want a yes, no answer. And I'm going to tell you, it's more gray. So if you're young and you're active, then the threshold for leucine to stimulate protein synthesis is lower. So you can get away with lower quantities of either protein or lower leucine containing proteins, so plant-based proteins, because they're lower in essential amino acids. Leucine is one. And you can still, build muscle. It's not as big a deal as we once thought. As you get older and probably a little less active, we've all agreed everything doesn't matter if you're an earthworm all the way to a human. As you're older, you do less. You need more leucine, because the trigger isn't the leucine threshold is, it doesn't come down quite as much. And if you're completely inactive or if you're sick, then the trigger threshold goes up even higher. So that's why the increased protein requirements for those individuals are, my opinion at least, are higher. So I think the quality of the protein matters. Animal proteins, yes, tend to have more essential amino acids than plant-based proteins. But this is a message that, I've softened on mainly because of new science that's come out. And, people get upset. They're like, oh, you changed your mind. And I'm like, well, science is always an evolutionary. Yeah, what kind of scientist would I be if I just kept saying the same in the face of overwhelming evidence to the contrary? So, that point is that I think that there's probably now more opportunities to get the plant-based proteins that are still of high enough quality. And now that we are isolating plant proteins, so you can get pea protein, you can get, soy's been around forever, but you can get rice, you can get all kinds of things that you couldn't have access to before. But now all of the protein quality lowering nutrients, fiber and anti-nutritionals, have been taken out of the equation because it's just the protein powder itself. And in that situation, I don't think, this sort of difference in protein quality is quite as big a deal. For older people, maybe. Hopefully we're going to do a little bit of work in that area to maybe uncover that to some degree.
Are you what do you follow? Are you a plant-based? Are you a carnivore? What diet do you follow?
I'm definitely not a carnivore, and I'm not a vegetarian or a vegan. I do eat meat, and eat eggs, and I drink a fair amount of, I'll say yogurt for the most part is the dairy source. Don't drink a lot of milk, to be honest. But I've increased the amount of plant-based foods that I eat. I try and make sure that there's always some sort of fruit or vegetable on the plate that is in front of me. And that goes from breakfast all the way to dinner. I absolutely refuse to drink any form of energy unless it's got some nutrition in it. So, you know, orange juice and pop or soda, anything with sugar, I'm just like, it's a waste of calories. You know, if I'm going to put something in my body, it's got to give me something back. And you know, that might be a bar of chocolate because I'm hopeless around chocolate. It's like kryptonite for me, but you know, it's enjoyment that I get out of that. It's maybe not be doing me too much good, but you know, maybe if it's darker, it's better. But you know, I exercise now to be able to, you know, hopefully the event horizons, you know, way off in the future. And to be able to enjoy some food, exercise is the forgiver of many sins. Maybe the occasional overindulgence is one of them. So,
yeah, no, look, you're doing fine. Okay. When it comes to the chocolate, because that's my kryptonite as well. And I don't drink alcohol.
We're on board.
Yeah. Awesome. But chocolate, my dream is to be stuck in Charlie's Chocolate Factory. Okay.
Yeah.
Now, before we move into the end, I do want to cover creatine. I speak about creatine as it relates to brain health, and I think that that's misunderstood, but I'd like to understand creatine, and I think a lot of women are also scared of taking creatine in the event that they might look bulky and swollen and fat. So let's first understand what it is and if we should be taking it.
Yeah. So creatine is a supplement, most of which it gets stored in skeletal muscle and it's phosphorylated. So it becomes phosphocreatine. And, you know, most of us have learned in basic biology, there are three fuel systems. Phosphocreatine is the immediate energy buffer. Glycolysis is sort of the intermediate one. And then oxidative phosphorylation, mitochondria, is the one that generates a lot of fuel. What I think is happening, so let's start out with the safety profile. So creatine's been around as a supplement for probably close to about 50 years now, at least 40 in mainstream usage. The safety data and the record on it is very good. There's not been a wave of people, you know, getting cancer or anything or something associated with taking creatine supplements. And, you know, that having been said, it's the one supplement that stood the test of, I'll call it test of time, in terms of it's been shown to be effective in aiding, you know, it buffers against repeated high intensity work. You can do more work when you're taking creatine. And it also, as you point out, and this has sort of been one of these unexpected, I'll call it side effects or off target effects, that it improves energetics in your brain. What we're beginning to see now with aging is that a lot of the fundamental deficits that occur with aging are mitochondrial related. So they're an energy crisis within the cell. That's within the muscle, and it's also true within brain as well. You know, a lot of cognitive dementia related diseases are called type 3 diabetes. So your brain has some sort of energy crisis going on, and you know, for a lot of reasons, the creatine that you take, once it gets phosphorylated, provides a little bit of a buffer against those sort of things. At least that's my interpretation of the literature that's out there. My supplement shelf is short, and I'll say that it's the one supplement that appears on there that I'm taking on a daily basis. And, you know, a lot of people are like, oh my, you're going to kill you. And I'm like, well, I guess I'll take my chances, but I like what it does for my, my aging muscles, but I'm really a fan of what it does for brain as well. Women who are afraid, you know, this is an interesting observation. Some guys who respond, quote unquote, to creatine gain a lot of weight. It's probably water weight, water retention, particularly in their muscles. Women don't tend to see that type of response. Some do, but most of them don't. So I certainly wouldn't be afraid of it. And if you're afraid of this sort of sudden weight gain, I would try to microdosing, but take about 3 grams a day just for a prolonged period, load your muscle up and see how you feel. If you're gaining weight at the same time where you feel bloated or something like that, then maybe it's not for you. But most women who I've talked to who take it find that that gradual sort of small dosing is preferable to the big loading dose that a lot of people recommend.
I feel invincible when I take it. in the morning before I go to the gym. I feel I'm like, I'm at the gym, and sometimes I forget I've taken it, and I'm like, wow, like, why am I like just lifting? And I'm, and it actually drives my motivation to keep going. Cause sometimes like three or four exercises into it of three or four sets per, I'm like, I'm done. I just want to leave. Like yeah. I love doing weights, but you know, at the same time, I'm like, I just want to be done. But when I take creatine, for some reason, it just keeps just pushing me further. So I feel good when I take it.
Yeah, we've done several studies now with older individuals, and it definitely allows them to get stronger. It allows them to gain more muscle. And it even has some probably effects that tip over into the cognitive sphere, which we've been able to detect on certain sort of executive function tasks, for example. Now they're always combined with exercise. So I can't leave telling you that it's all just the supplement. It's probably exercise and supplement related. Again, it's a synergism. Here's the supplement effect. Here's the exercise effect. The two together much more than either independently.
Does it matter what age? So could I, you know, dose my parents up, not dose them up, but maybe like in, it doesn't matter if you're 60, 70, 80 and you're taking creatine?
I don't know. I don't think so. I would think at some age it may, you know, once it's like a lot of things with aging. Once you've started to sort of, you know, tip down, it's harder to kind of, you know, right the ship, so to speak, in terms of bending the relationship back up. It's probably better to take it earlier in life, in that it would sort of, it's easier to slow the decline than it is to, you know, sort of bend the curve back up once you're older. I don't think it's a bad thing. And I would be really interested, you know, if there were some larger trials in populations, you know, with some sort of dementia or Alzheimer's or something like that, to see what it would do. I don't think those studies have been done. I don't read as much in that area, but would be that in combination with exercise, because let's face it, for those things, unfortunately, the drugs that have been developed are just not that great. So I think lifestyle is, you know, it's really under, say, recognized or underrepresented in the literature as a preventive treatment for sure.
I think even exercise and lifestyle interventions when it comes to neurodegenerative diseases in the literature, clinical studies really shows that not just prevention, but even if you've been diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease, still at the end of the day, which beats all of the pharmacological agents that are out there, it still comes down to exercise and then sleep. And these are lifestyle interventions.
Well, it's music to my ears to hear you say that. We have a really nice paper. I think it's going to come out either January or February in a new journal. I'm just blanking on the name. Exercise and Sport Medicine, or Exercise and Sport Reviews or something. And it's a graphical review of resistance training. And in there, we've drawn lots of figures, pretty colored figures, to try and illustrate the concept. And one of the things that's been surprising to me when we were reviewing the literature around, as you said, cognitive decline is it's a pretty powerful effect. So we try and stress that in the review for sure.
I cannot wait for that to come out. I'm going to be putting that out there on social media, especially now that you said there's colored diagrams.
It's open access. Everybody can. So and you know, I drew none of them. So I you know, it's the architects that I work with, some great postdoctoral fellows who did all the creative work. And I try to say, you know, let's try and put it in a picture that's worth 1,000 words or probably more. As to the benefits, and it's all around resistance training. But I was super impressed when I got into that and did some reading in that area, just how powerful some of these effects are.
Is this a review article or a systematic? Yeah. Okay, fantastic. All right, let's do some practical tips just to finish up the episode. Practical tips for the best way to increase muscle mass.
You have to lift weights. You've got to do something resistive. If it's a push-up, you know, so be it. If it's one of these elasticated bars or resistance bands, they're very effective. There's some really good ones out there. They're not this, you know, just the TheraBands like we used to have. Really good, high quality stuff. Go for a walk every day. You know, do something. You know, the less you do, the more your risk goes up. Resistance training is still important for sure.
And is the amount of quantity, is the amount of protein that we get per day more important than where we're getting it from in terms of, are we getting it from animal or plant?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, top of the list is make sure you're hitting your protein target. It should be at a minimum, I think, 1.2 grams per kilogram of body weight per day, and probably optimally closer to about 1.6. A lot of people talk about, you know, wringing a little bit more out of the cloth and going higher just to make sure. I don't see any evidence for that, but if that's your thing, go for it.
I love that. Where can we follow along with you? Where are you most active on social media?
Yeah, so I have, I'm on Facebook, smp.phd. I'm on Twitter as MacKinProf. I'm on Instagram as MacKinProf. I've been warned off of TikTok by my kids. So they say old people ruin TikTok, but I may get on TikTok because I'm beginning to not like being on Twitter quite as much.
All right, we're going to link all of those. Thank you so much, Stu, for being part of the NeuroExperience podcast.
My pleasure, Louisa. Thanks for having me on the podcast. Appreciate it.